Welcome to episode 19 of BioRossi's Few and Far Between, conversations on the cutting edge of clinical research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. Today's guest calls himself a survivor, but he is so much more than that. Leslie Michelson is a true pioneer in the field of patient advocacy. Currently, he is the founder and executive chairman at Private Health Management, a company of clinical research and care management experts committed to providing access to the best of what's possible in medicine. Leslie is also the creator of the Prostate Cancer Foundation, the world's leading philanthropic organization dedicated to funding life-saving prostate cancer research. And he's the author of The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. All of these accomplishments and experiences add up to a mission and a personal philosophy laser-focused on the need for patient advocacy, support, and guidance in our complex healthcare system. In this episode, we're going to talk about Leslie's remarkable journey, his goal to make a difference in the world starting at the age of 12, and his continuing objective of accessible healthcare for everyone. His chutzpah and dedication continue to be inspiring and instrumental in the rise of patient advocacy. I really enjoyed my conversation with Leslie, and I hope you will too. Welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research and drug development. I'm Chris O'Brien, your host. Today, my guest is Leslie Michelson. I am very excited for this chat. Leslie created one of the premier cancer advocacy organizations in the world, the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and he's done important work in helping patients navigate our incredibly complex medical system in the United States. He's done this through his book, The Patient Playbook, and now through his company, Private Health. So we're going to have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. But first, welcome, Leslie, and thanks for joining us.
Chris, thank you so much. It's truly my privilege. I've monitored what you guys have been doing, and it's very impressive. So it's really a joy for me to be able to participate for at least a few minutes here.
Thank you. All right, well, let's jump right in. And I think great if you could start a little bit with telling us about your background. I know that, like many people who work in any aspect of the medical field, this is a mission for you. And I think some of it's shaped by your early life. So would you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Like many people who are listening, my early childhood was dominated in many respects by an illness that my mother had. After I was born, she went into a postpartum depression. And when she came out of it, she was bipolar. This was a disease for which there were no meaningful treatments for a long time. And I started being a patient advocate and understanding the importance of health when I was 12 years old, when I teamed with my dad to take care of my mom. So I was, violating the child labor laws, but I did what I needed to do to support my mom, my dad, and my family. And then about 6 years later, when I was in high school, my dad was told that he needed open heart surgery early in when they were doing that procedure. And I didn't think that he was going to survive that. I was worried about that. So I made one call to the chairman of cardiology at a major teaching hospital in New York City, got my father a second opinion. I'd never heard those two words put together before. He went to see the chairman of cardiology, who said he didn't need the procedure. There's absolutely nothing wrong with his heart. He lived 44 more years, never had a cardiovascular issue, succumbed to something very different. We got the full measure of his life. And just about every day, I think about that one phone call that I made as an 18-year-old kid that changed the entire course of my life, my family's life, and made a big difference. So for all of those of you out there that are doing similar things for your relatives, you can be a victim or you can be a survivor. You have a choice to make. I decided to be a survivor. And what I learned is that it actually gave me my life's mission. So it ended up being a blessing in so many ways. My life has been so much richer, so much more fulfilling. And I think I've been able to accomplish a lot more, make a bigger difference in the world as a result of those unfortunate developments early in my life.
What an extraordinary story. Both parts of it, the advocacy for your mom, when I assume you had never heard the term patient advocate at the age of 12. I guess we can assume you had no formal training. Tell us about the decision to make that call. Do you recall what motivated you to try to do that? Or was this just pure chutzpah? I guess there were no connections there, or was there something?
This was survival. Mm-hmm. There we were. I was taking care of my mom a lot. I was a good student in school. I had aspirations to go to a great college. My dad was a hardworking guy, worked 6 days a week. I didn't know how much money we had. I didn't think we had very much. We always had food on the table, but it wasn't a lot more than that. And I was just really worried about losing my dad, because if I lost my dad, I'd lose the opportunity for my dreams to become reality. I lived in suburban New Jersey. We didn't have the internet. We barely had a phone book for New York. We all knew that when you went to New York, you sort of got better food and better Broadway plays and better everything. The one hospital I knew the name of in New York was Lenox Hill. So I just dialed Lenox Hill. I mean, literally dialed on a dial on a phone that was actually connected to the wall with a wire, didn't fit in your pocket. And I had the chutzpah to ask for the chairman of cardiology. And just because I'm a survivor. The lesson it taught me was even the people at the top of the game are happy to take care of people, particularly when there's an advocate at the table, because it changes the way they perceive who you are. Because if you're somebody else making that call on behalf of someone, it signals to the gatekeeper, to the scheduler, to the physician that this person is loved by somebody else.
Wow.
It makes a subtle, but I think very powerful difference.
And I guess your point, you obviously will get to private health management later in the conversation. This is continues to be an important part of your life's work, but you're suggesting that ordinary people can play an important role in advocating for their family members or their friends as well, I guess, yeah?
I was less than ordinary. I was 18. Anybody can do it. You just need the courage. And it's so much easier to do right now and so much more important. It's easier because we have access to information through the internet. And it's more important because the difference, the gradient between the outcome that you're going to get when you get to the very top physicians and you get the state-of-the-art care and what you would get from average or sub-average care is just growing with every single article published in the New England Journal, in JAMA, in all of the articles. The gradient is enormous between the highest quality of care and mediocre care. And you need an advocate to help bring that about, and you can do it. If I did it when I was 18, you can do it today.
That's wonderful. And that's certainly one of the lessons I think people will take away from this conversation. You go to college, you go to law school, you work as a lawyer, I think for a little while, right? For a while?
Yeah, for a couple of years. I never was sort of destined to be a lawyer. I didn't like the practice of law. I loved the legal education and I loved the importance of the law. I learned how to think. I learned how to analyze data. I learned how to advocate. And I decided to take whatever talent I had and the blessing of the education I was able to get and deploy it into helping people get better medical care.
Is there a chapter you want to talk about before we get to the Prostate Cancer Foundation?
It was not exactly a linear path, but you can pull lines through it. So from the time I shifted from practicing law to running healthcare companies, everyone I knew from all of my prior lives, when they got sick, called me. Because nobody knows what to do when they get sick. Nobody does. So even before I got to the Prostate Cancer Foundation, everybody I knew and everybody they knew, their friends, relatives, their nannies, their grandparents would call me. And I built a little practice, if you would, with just me at night with my phone, with access to the internet, with a small ragtag group of volunteers, helping people identify top experts, gain access to them, and guide and support them through very difficult medical issues. And it was my avocation. I did it instead of almost anything else. I did it instead of lunch, instead of dinner, instead of going to ball games and trying to hit these little ping pong balls with little dimples in them into Campbell's soup cans and these green pastures that I was never good at anyway. And it became a passion for me.
Some folks play golf. Other people provide mentorship to people in need, I guess. That's lovely. So tell me where you want to go next. Do you want to talk about Patient Playbook and what led to that? Or shall we talk about the Prostate Cancer Foundation? What comes next in the chronology of your life?
Well, chronologically, it's the Prostate Cancer Foundation. I had an extraordinary event happen to me in 2001. I was sitting at this very desk, actually, doing some work in my home office. And I got a call from a brilliant financier by the name of Mike Milken. I thought it was one of my buddies sort of doing the business on me, saying it was Mike Milken to get me to answer the phone or something. But it was Mike Milken literally on the phone. It was a Friday afternoon at about 4 o'clock. Called me to say he had this prostate cancer thing. It was then called CapCure. They needed a new CEO. And he said, everybody's told him I should be the CEO. I said, Mike, you're very kind. I'm flattered in words I can't even put together, but I don't know anything about running a philanthropy. And he said, well, that's good because if you did, you'd be disqualified. Let's get together and talk. 2 weeks later, I was in the CEO's chair running the world's largest philanthropy funding research for prostate cancer.
So you get that call. What's your decision process like? How do you decide that's the right next step for you?
Well, I play for impact. I like to make a difference in the world. If you're going to be awake and you're going to be working, you may as well do work that's going to make a big difference. I thought about it for a little bit. I knew the incidence of prostate cancer. It's the highest incidence in men of any of the cancers. I knew it attacks men in the age cohort I was about to get into. And I knew a lot of my friends, and they have, were going to get diagnosed with prostate cancer. And I knew Mike played at the top of the game, and it would be a great opportunity for me to learn about how to make a difference in getting better treatments through the FDA, getting them developed, as well as how to take care of people with a very serious disease. And it turned out to be one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, dealing with the very top experts across the country and around the world, not only in prostate cancer research, but across all cancers and really across all diseases, you know, interacting with the head of the FDA, with top research scientists at the NIH, chairs of the departments at many of the major hospitals.
Fascinating. So you get into the chair, it's a couple of weeks later. I think, am I right in this? I think Mike had suffered from prostate cancer himself. Is that correct? Or
Yeah. Mike had had a very bad case of prostate cancer, and it was a case that most of the docs said would probably been terminal in a couple of years. He's now, I think, 35 years out with no evidence of disease. It illuminated one of my theories about philanthropy. Many of you I know are interested in philanthropic activity. And one of my theses about philanthropy, particularly in healthcare, is when the person launching the philanthropic initiative has had some of their stability, some of their security taken away from them by disease, by violence at home, or by something else, and they decide, they make that choice, and it's a binary choice. You're either going to be a victim, you're going to be a survivor. And if you take that path to be a survivor, and then you decide that you're going to help other people avoid the type of thing that destroyed your personal security, you're motivated by your personal experience as I am, I think the philanthropies are generally much more successful. So you look across what Susan G. Komen has done, Michael Fox and others, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, many of these disease-specific philanthropies have been launched by individuals who've either suffered from the disease or had a family member who suffered from the disease. And that gives them the personal knowledge, the passion, the desire, the insatiable source of energy, which is what you need to make a big difference in defeating these diseases.
So obviously, Mike Milken, in addition to having that passion, brilliant and very talented guy, and had a lot of resources. So you knew that coming in, that you had the backing of and the commitment from him. I think if I remember correctly, there was another significant person who was involved in this exercise as well, another well-known CEO. Is that right?
Yeah. So Andy Grove was the founder of Intel. He had suffered from prostate cancer. He was very active on our board. He's an iconic business leader, basically one of the key initial CEOs of Silicon Valley and the entire tech industry. We also had participation from David Koch, who is a multi-billionaire in the energy business, and lots of other CEOs of major organizations. So I got to interact with people at the top of the business world who were taking some of the wealth that they had created from those successful businesses, but even more importantly, donating to our cause, their expertise, their intensity, their creativity, their capacity to make a difference. And I'll take that energy and intellect and drive any day. The money is important. There's no question about it. But a scarcer resource is people who know how to change the world, dedicating themselves and that skill set into the realm of philanthropy focused on developing better treatments, particularly for the rare diseases that need them.
Okay, so you arrive, you're sitting in the chair, you know you have a real need, you know that prostate cancer is, as you just said, the number one cancer in men. It happens to afflict this cohort of people who are getting towards the peak of their careers, and you have this extraordinary group of advisors and access to resources. So it was easy, Leslie? It was a piece of cake? Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know what the opposite of this a piece of cake, and I don't know if I thought what it was, if I could say it legitimately on a podcast, but it's one of the hardest things you can do. I mean, biology is so complicated. The regulatory pathways are so complicated. When you get involved in the politics of academic institutions, you get IP issues. It's an extraordinarily complex thing to do. And we started to raise a whole lot of money because Mike is such a brilliant expert. He is so well respected. And the caliber of the people who were involved were very, very generous donors to what we were doing. And a point came where I wasn't quite sure what to do with all of the money and all of the power that we had accumulated, because I wanted to make sure that as a fiduciary, not only for our donors, but in a more important sense, a fiduciary for everybody who had prostate cancer was going to get it. I wanted to make sure that we were donating and supporting the cause in a way that was going to make the biggest difference. So I got scared, which doesn't happen to me often, because I wasn't 100% confident that I knew what to do. So I reached out to the CEOs of a variety of other disease-specific philanthropies and asked them, what are you doing to make a difference? I see you're raising money, but how do you think about, you know, spending that money, investing that money? What changes in the system are you trying to make? Where are you deploying your dollars, your hours, and your energy, and your resources? And what happened was all of those people said, you know what? This is really hard. And we all started talking about it and decided with Mike's leadership that we would put together a new philanthropy called Faster Cures. So Faster Cures is basically a resource for the leaders of philanthropies across the entire healthcare spectrum that are focused on accelerating biomedical research, because there are common obstacles across all diseases and there are unique obstacles to individual diseases.
So you created then through Faster Cures kind of a ginormous advisory board for you and for the other participants, a set of best practices, a set of guidelines, but not just from a couple of people, but from quite a broad community, sounds like.
Right. And the vision behind it is we've got locomotives that can go at 500 miles an hour. The problem is the track doesn't permit that. So we need to figure out how to straighten out the track so that the engine called biomedical research can move more quickly. And some of that straightening of the track and improving the quality of the track and facilitating of smarter designs of clinical trials, more efficient ways to recruit patients for clinical trials, particularly for rare diseases, figuring out how you'd handle the intellectual property issues, getting the physicians lined up, taking out the friction of contracting with principal investigators and others, all of that stuff matters. And if this were purely commercial enterprises, people would have figured it out. But because it's not only commercial enterprises, but academic institutions, the NIH, as well as philanthropies, it's a much more complex ecosystem.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. One of the early challenges you had to wrestle with was the name of the organization. So will you tell us a little bit about that story?
It's a funny story. I'm not a good guy with names, but we were initially called CapCure when I got there, and I didn't even know what that meant. And it took me like 8 weeks to find somebody to tell me what the origin of the name was. And CAP is the pathologist abbreviation for cancer of the prostate. It's also the name of what you put on your head. So it was a little weird to me, and it was about cure. So yeah, it didn't really resonate to people. And I thought, you know, we got to have a better name, because I was calling people, calling my network of people, saying, I got this great new job. I'm at CapCure now. And they'd say, what are you doing? I'm working with Mike Milken. Oh, so you're doing recapping companies that have, you know, junk bonds? No, it had nothing to do with that. We're curing prostate cancer. Well, why do you call it CapCure? I said, yeah, it's a good question. So one night when I was just, you know, sitting here literally at this chair, wandering around the internet as many of us do, I said, you know what? I wonder if we could get a better name. I just typed in Prostate Cancer Foundation, and the URL prostatecancerfoundation.org was available. So I took out my credit card, and I bought it for $7.50. Okay, so I've got the URL now. Now I got to see if I can persuade my board that we can change our name. And it took a little while, but everybody got on board. And it just made it easier for us, for people immediately to know who we were, what we were doing, and that we were the class act. We were the top of the game. And it just opened up all kinds of doors. So it was simple, but it made a big difference.
It's a really interesting point. You know, some entrepreneurs in the for-profit and in the nonprofit worlds will say that names don't matter, and other people believe that names matter a lot. And I think, if I remember correctly, you did some polling that was part of the persuasion of your board. Will you tell that story?
Well, it was a funny story. So I knew I would have an uphill battle, because it's always an uphill battle to change a name, always. And the people that are inside like the name because they've grown up with it. They created it. So I did some market research. We did 200 mall intercepts in like five different states over a 10-day period, in which we had people with clipboards asking people in the mall, we listed about 10 or 15 different philanthropies, from Susan G. Komen to the American Heart Association, American Cancer Society, all of the big names, Prostate Cancer Foundation, which at the time only existed on my credit card bill. It's the only place it existed. CapCure and others, and ask them, do you think this is the preeminent philanthropy in that area? Would you support it? Are they credible? Have they made a big difference? And on every one of those, the Prostate Cancer Foundation was either at the 50th percentile or above. It didn't exist except on my credit card receipt. And CapCure was down near the bottom. So I presented this data to Mike and the board, and there was some moaning and groaning. Is this legitimate? Blah, blah, blah. And they said, all right, let's change the name. And then we did.
If it turns out that the non-existent philanthropy was more credible than the existent philanthropy, at least at the level of name recognition. Yeah.
Because people believe that the Prostate Cancer Foundation needed to exist, and it would be a surprise that it didn't. Well, it did. It was just camouflaged.
It's a great lesson if you're listening to this and you're thinking about how to persuade your boss or your board of some change, because people are inherently conservative on this. Changing a name does carry risks with it, as you just pointed out, Leslie. And that's a pretty good example of when you know you've got a winner, is when the imaginary one has more name recognition than the existing one.
Yeah, I got lucky. It wasn't without risk, though, because when you early in a career in a business, when you take a position like that and challenge something as emotional as a name, you take some risk.
You also shared with me in a previous conversation something about the risks of having multiple competing philanthropies aimed at the same disease, and the benefit that you get if you can be a uniter and bring together the folks that are concerned about this issue. Will you talk a little bit about that, about how you thought about it?
Yeah. So I believe in a free market economy. I believe in competition. In philanthropy, it's a little bit different, though, because what I learned when I went out to talk to my colleagues who are leading other philanthropies for different diseases, and I would always ask them, how much of your time is spent collaborating with others in the same space, and how much of your energy is spent because you might have different views? And to a one, they said way too much energy is spent in conflict with other disease-specific philanthropies in the same space. We wish we could find common ground, but it's hard to do. For some reason that I don't quite understand, it's harder to do in a philanthropic environment.
So it sounds like that name change, I know I'm dwelling on this, but I love it because it was both forward-looking and expansive, because it enabled you to really take this dominant position and expand upon it, but also defensive because it made it more likely that somebody else was going to join you rather than create a competing one, because you sounded like the convening authority once you'd changed the name.
And in fact, we were the convening authority because we did have the largest checkbook, and we were doing the most work by a wide, wide margin. It just made it easier to maintain that position. And again, given the complexity of the ecosystem, given the difficulty of making meaningful progress in biomedical research, the science is moving at warp speed. It's just the obstacles and the bureaucracy and the decision-making and the approval processes that are so much more difficult. At least for us, it made a difference that we were the only meaningful player, because it gave us more power to deal with the FDA, to deal with the principal investigators, to deal with the academic institutions, to deal with the biopharmaceutical industry. And it enabled us, I think, to be more successful.
That's great. So if you can put yourself back into that head, we'll move off of Prostate Cancer Foundation in a second, but if you can put yourself back into the headspace that you were in those early days, and you were giving advice then to somebody else who's new in a chair, whether that's new as a CEO of a for-profit organization, we have, you know, plenty of listeners who are leading or playing leading roles in startup biotechs, for example, or in the nonprofit world or in patient advocacy. Any recommendations for how to think in those early days about actions you should consider taking?
Yeah. Again, it goes to the complexity of making progress. Everyone else, other than a philanthropy, has limitations on what they can do. Businesses, whether they're, you know, biotech startups or giant pharmaceutical companies, have obligations to their investors, and they need to function to make money. It's not to say that they're immoral, but they need to do that. That's their obligation. The federal government has constraints on what it does. The NIH can only do certain things. Academic institutions have to treat patients as they're doing research. Practicing physicians out of academic institutions need to treat patients in ways that make money for them, or they're going to be out of business. Philanthropies have far greater latitude in terms of what they can do. And what I would invite everybody who's involved and passionate about developing better treatments and defeating diseases is to really spend time thinking about the complexity of the ecosystem in which they find themselves and identify the particular levers they can activate that are going to make the biggest difference. So for us, for example, in prostate cancer, a couple of things that were important to us. There are very few clinical trials underway in prostate cancer at the time because, thank God, prostate cancer is a very slow developing disease. And the 5 and 10 year survival of prostate cancer are very long, which is a wonderful thing for the men who contract the diagnosis, but a bad thing for major pharmaceutical businesses because they're looking at 10, 15 year paybacks on their investments. And they'd much rather invest, and rationally so, in something else. So what did we need to do? We did two very clever things. One was we organized the principal investigators so that it was easier, less expensive, and faster for the biopharmaceutical industry to contract with them. So we had a clinical trial consortium where, with the execution of one agreement with one IRB, with one contract across all the institutions, it oversimplifies it a little bit, you could launch a clinical trial and you could have more institutions participate, just as the great work that you and your organization do, Chris, because patient recruitment is so important to the success of a clinical trial and drives a lot of the profitability of the result because of the speed with which you can get it done. So the first thing we did is we organized the principal investigators. And secondly, we worked on developing surrogate markers so that if mortality is ultimately the outcome that you want to influence, which is, of course, what you want, and it's 5 to 10 to 15 years, that's a tough clinical trial to run. But if you can identify surrogate markers that reliably enough predict that outcome, that can be measured earlier and validated earlier, you've changed the entire economics of the investment in the treatment of the disease. So that's one thing. Another thing to look at is, and we're talking about rare diseases. Well, it turns out that if you really look at it, most of the cancers today are becoming rare diseases. Now, that sounds weird, but you know, when I was born, there was a breast cancer. That was it. Now we know there are dozens and dozens and dozens of breast cancers because we're looking at all the different mutations that are causing it. So by understanding at a very granular level the heterogeneity of the cause of the disease, you open up the window to develop better treatments. So cystic fibrosis is a great example, where there are now drugs on the market for those forms of cystic fibrosis that are caused by one particular mutation as opposed to another. And my thesis is that across the board for cancers, increasingly true. So for us in prostate cancer, it isn't that true. It isn't as consequential as it is in other cancers, but I'd invite everybody to think strategically before they start deploying their capital to figure out what levers they can activate that will make the biggest difference in the near term.
So Leslie, when you think about that now, looking back, and maybe this is not quite fair because prostate cancer, as you said, these distinctions of different tumor types, et cetera, less relevant perhaps. The progress that you guys were able to make, do you think was more about the process improvement and logistics things that you did that enabled patient recruitment, made it easier, or more about strategic decisions about where we're going to fund research and what you're going to focus on?
I think it was a combination of both, honestly. So it was clearly simplifying the process, developing better surrogate markers, and importantly, organizing the community so that it could work efficiently. So one of the things that we did is when we funded a researcher, every researcher who was a recipient of a grant of ours was required, obligatorily required, to show up at our annual prostate cancer retreat and report on their results to their 350 peers across the country and around the world. We believe in accountability. So there's none of this, give the money to Dr. Smith, he's a brilliant person, she's a fabulous researcher, and trust them. Let's make sure that they report back to their colleagues so that the information, A, is shared, and B, there's accountability for the results as well.
That's terrific. I want to quickly flip to clinical research and a couple of points you made about that. You had a background in clinical research. You'd started a company in this space before. But will you talk a little bit about a couple of the lessons that you took away from there? I'm thinking specifically about taking your time with patients and thank you notes.
There's a lot to be done that could improve the process of conducting clinical trials. And I spent a lot of time with patients having discussions about whether they should participate in a clinical trial, and with physicians about how they think about clinical trials. And for all of the the informed consent, there's issues that I think could be addressed that would take clinical trials out of the realm for some people who think of them as being guinea pigs and it being risky, which I think is an inaccurate description, and really make it something that everybody thinks about as part of their duty as a member of a society. And I think if we could change that perspective, it would be terrific. So, I mean, calling a patient a subject is a bit of a difficult thing. Yes, that's accurate. It's true, but it's a human being and it's somebody that's got a disease. And you might want to think about them a little bit differently. And there are things that can be done. So, for example, if I were running the world, which I will tell you, my wife would think would be an extremely frightening prospect. And I do too, actually. But there's things that could be done that could be better. So, for example, telling patients that they're going to get a report on the results of the clinical trial that they participate in. Mm-hmm. Sending a thank you note from the principal investigator or the sponsor for the person taking the time to do it. A lot of the clinical research, as you know, Chris, is funded by the federal government. Now, I've had the opportunity to be in the White House a number of times. I've had the privilege of meeting a number of our presidents and seeing their signatures on pieces of paper. And oh my God, it sends a bolt of lightning through your body when you see the signature of the President of the United States of America. For clinical trials funded by the federal government, why doesn't every participant get a letter signed by the President of the United States? They got these robo pens where it's exactly the signature of the president with wet ink, and it's just, you can't tell the difference. Cannot tell the difference. And how much could it possibly cost to send every participant in an NIH-funded clinical trial a thank you letter from the President of the United States for being an American hero?
I love it. I think we are often in clinical research a little too far away from the patient in our thinking, and saying thank you and taking time to explain the value of the study and even sharing the results of the study are terrific ideas for ways to make this feel more like a shared responsibility that we all have.
Yeah, just in promoting the safety of clinical trials.
Since we're talking about the patient, let's talk a little bit about the patient playbook. I know we don't have too much time left, but I want to make sure we spend a couple of minutes on that and on private health management. So you want to tell the story of the patient playbook first?
Sure. So as you now know, I've spent really the mission of my life is helping people get better healthcare. That's what I love to do. That is my personal mission. And it was given to me along with many, many other blessings and gifts by both of my parents. So it's sort of what I was put here to do. And I did as much as I could as a solo individual, voluntarily helping people at night and instead of lunch and instead of playing golf. I did that for as long as I could. I then started a business called Private Health Management, which takes care of people in a very sophisticated way, particularly people with significant disease. We serve individuals with all manner of difficult issues as well as individuals who are quite well. And we get retained by major corporations who bring us in as a benefit to be provided, paid for by the company, to all of their employees and their dependents, because we are experts at navigating the healthcare system. We are experts at educating patients, of synthesizing the perspectives of top experts, juxtaposing it against the findings in the medical literature, and getting people just a better experience, better treatment, and optimal outcomes in healthcare. So I've done all of that, but there was a gap because there are many people who, as individuals, can't afford our services at private health and don't happen to be employees or dependents of our corporate clients. So I decided, what am I going to do about that gap? Because that gnaws at me because of my passion for all this. So I decided I would write a book. And I had this happenstance of getting a profile in the Wall Street Journal that elevated my profile on all of this. And I decided to key off of that to see if I could get an opportunity to write a book. So I wrote an outline. I got myself an agent. Turned out that the agent that I had 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 an unfortunate experience with the healthcare system that, as many people do, I kind of got lucky that her hard luck was beneficial. She was a great agent. I ended up getting a contract with Knopf to write the book, the preeminent publisher in the world. I had a terrific person by the name of Lisa Swedenham who wrote the book with me. And the book is intended to expose the experiences I've had taking care of hundreds and hundreds of people over the years and distilling it down to lessons that absolutely anybody can learn from and do to take care of themselves or a loved one who has a significant disease, whether it be a rare disease or a more common disease. So it's meant to be a guidebook for individuals. So if I can't get the time to talk to them, if they can't afford our services, aren't an employee or dependent of a company that uses us, you can get the patient's playbook on Amazon.com for 10 bucks or whatever, and it can teach you everything I could possibly teach you to make it easier for you to navigate the healthcare system.
That's wonderful, Leslie. It's great work that you're doing both at Private Health in the book and previously through the Prostate Cancer Foundation and your full career here in healthcare. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us today. Really encourage people to check out the book. You can also go to privatehealth.com to learn more about the company and what they offer. And Leslie, are you on social media? Is there a place people should go to follow you, or should they follow Private Health online?
Much easier to follow Private Health online. They're much more active in social media than I am. And I can't let this podcast end without kudos to you, Chris, and your colleagues at Biorossi, because what you are doing is so important, particularly for the rare diseases and the clinical trials that are having challenges or should be or might be having challenges without the benefit of your expertise in recruiting patients. It is so important to get those clinical trials enrolled and get those results because the science is there. There's no reason for enrollment issues to delay the introduction of life-saving treatments and other technologies. So it's great to spend time with you. I'm in awe of what you do, and thanks for the opportunity to talk to your terrific audience.
You're kind to share all of that, Leslie. Thanks for spending time with us today. This was really fun.
My privilege. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. They really help. See you next time.